Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And we're trying to create the context for you so that it would help as you involve and you continue in your intimate relationship with your Lord and Savior of what do we need to do and how can we help? How can we participate in restoring liberty? We're going through the Constitutional Convention, and welcome back, Sean. And we are kind of going through the heir apparent, how the framers were literally being kind of abusive to the illiterate and those who, are too dumb to vote or what have you. And so they've kind of broached that point in the convention where they're kind of talking about this. And there was a go back, I think. What was that go back? Do you remember?
The go back was that the framers obviously and evidently did not trust the common man, but they still structured and framed a government that represented them.
Right. But I think they were able to go, because I kind of covered this, but I think they had a clear conscience that they weren't putting the keys in a very dangerous car. It's kind of like, do you give car keys to a child to a high-performance system, a high-performance car like the Hellcat, or a car that just has so much muscle, so much power that, the kid could easily kill himself just, because he's just inexperienced, right? Well,
absolutely.
So I think the framers ultimately created a system where they felt safe handing the keys over to the people, more so than it's ever happened before. Because they did create a truly limited and defined government. And when we see today, the bane of our existence is just due to the fact that our education system and our government have been, I'll just say, lying to the people to say, yeah, we can give you anything and everything you want. Tell us what you want. Well, we want to have fun. We want to feel good. And so, okay, we're going to give you drugs, and we're going to let you have sex, and we're going to, just with reckless abandon, we're going to let you do whatever sex you want. And, I mean, we actually have a government that is the epitome of corruption. When we look back in the framers' days, Madison was abhorrent. When he ran his first election, he knew that buying drinks on election day was just morally wrong, and he thought it should be illegal. Well, it was legal, and he lost his first election, and he probably didn't want to spend any money doing it that way. But in his next election, guess what he did? He bought drinks on election day for all those people out there, and he won the election. But it still bothered him, and ultimately it became illegal to buy votes, because ultimately that's what you're doing. You're buying votes by giving them something now if you give me a vote. Back in those days, that was the only time government was involved in their lives, really. They hardly had any effect. Government hardly had any effect in everybody's life. But today, oh boy, they are in everybody's lives. And when you literally talk about politicians creating deals that they're going to give you your phones, they're going to give you this, they're going to give you this, they're creating these fraudulent scams to basically bolster up and create millionaires out of criminals. I mean, when we look at what the heck's going on today, how is that even legitimate? How is government and our public servants not buying influence when they're using the public trough to provide benefits to the people?
benefits that they don't constitutionally have the authority to offer, whether that be health care, whether that be SNAP, whatever it is. The day's going to come when the when everything goes bankrupt that the cheese is going to move and all the rats or all the mice that have been living off of government are going to have some real problems. And whether they survive or not, it's up to them. I would highly recommend, and it's a short read, it's an easy read. It's not a collegiate-level book. Who Moved My Cheese? Folks, go read it. Give that to people that are out there getting cheese from government, that are living, the communists and so forth. They need to read that book because the day's coming when the cheese is going to move and they won't be able to find any cheese. They're going to actually have to go out there and get it themselves. So with that, let me go back to where, do you remember where we are? As far as the notes, we are, I think we're still on.
Mr. Sherman.
Yes, Mr. Sherman on the 6th of June. Correct. And so, folks, that's what we're going to pick up right now. And so, as a matter of fact, what started this whole thing was, you know, the diatribe that we didn't get to Mr. Sherman at the end of yesterday was the fact that I was pointing out that, you know, all these different representatives from the different states, they all had the same opinion, it seemed like, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so Mr. Sherman, right here, go ahead, let's kick this off. Go ahead.
If it were in view to abolish the state governments, the elections ought to be by the people. If the state governments are to be continued, it is necessary in order to preserve harmony between national and state governments that the elections to the former should be made by the latter. The right of participating in the national government would be sufficiently secured to the people by their election of state legislatures. The objects of the Union, he thought, were few. 1, defense against foreign danger. 2, defense against internal disputes and a resort to force. 3, treaties with foreign nations. 4, regulating foreign commerce and drawing revenue from it. These and perhaps a few lesser objects alone rendered a confederation of the states necessary. All other matters, civil and criminal, would be much, much better in the hands of the states. The people are more happy in small than large states. States may indeed be too small as Rhode Island, and thereby be too subject to faction. Some others were perhaps too large, the powers of government not being able to pervade them. He was for giving the general government power to legislate and execute within a defined province.
Okay. So he's going back to the primary objects, right? And kind of reeling this back into some focus of, you know, defense against foreign danger, against internal disputes, a resort to force, you know, to collect taxes and so forth, the ability to create treaties and regulating foreign commerce and drawing revenue and so forth from it and so forth. So he was just trying to get, you know, us to get back into the game again and what we needed government to actually be, you know, what this government needed to do. So let's go ahead and see what Mr. Mason kind of throws into this. Go ahead.
Colonel Mason, under the existing Confederacy, Congress represents the states, not the people of the states. Their acts operate on the states, not on the individuals. The case will be changed in the new plan of government. The people will be represented. They ought, therefore, to choose the representatives. The requisites in actual representation are that the representatives should sympathize with their constituents, should think as they think and feel as they feel, and that for these purposes should even be residents among them. Much, he said, had been alleged against democratic elections. He admitted that much might be said, but it was to be considered that no government was free from imperfection and evils, and that improper elections in many instances were inseparable from Republican governments. But compare these with the advantage of this form in favor of the rights of the people, in favor of human nature. He was persuaded there was a better chance for proper elections by the people if divided into large districts, then by the state legislatures. Paper money had been issued by the latter when the former were against it. Was it to be supposed that the state legislators then would not send to the national legislature patrons of such projects if the choice depended on them?
Okay, interesting. Okay, so he's getting back to the people and giving the people. So Mason was a champion for the people. He was a champion of protecting the people and their rights. That's why, you know, he's, when it came to time to sign the Constitution, he said, I'd rather cut off my right arm than sign that document, because it didn't have a Bill of Rights. He felt that the people needed to be protected. So, you know, Mason was a bigger-than-life kind of guy as well. I mean, he had a very strong opinion, and he was unwielding. Wouldn't bend one bit. Now, Madison steps in. Let's see what Madison says. Now, another person, Mason from Virginia, now Madison from Virginia. Got two Virginians now speaking up. Go ahead.
Mr. Madison considered an election of one branch, at least of the legislature, by the people immediately as a clear principle of free government, and that this mode, under proper regulations, had the additional advantage of securing better representatives, as well as of avoiding too great an agency of the state governments in the general one. He differed from the member from Connecticut, Mr. Sherman, in thinking the objects mentioned to be all the principal ones that required a national government. Those were certainly important and necessary objects, but he combined with them the necessity of providing more effectually for the security of private rights and the steady dispensation of justice. Interferences with these were evils which had more, perhaps, than anything else produced this convention. Was it to be supposed that Republican liberty could long exist under the abuses of it practiced in some of the states? The gentleman, Mr. Sherman, had admitted that in a very small state, faction and oppression would prevail. It was to be inferred, then, that wherever these prevailed, the state was too small. Had they not prevailed in the largest as well as the smallest, though, less than in the smallest? And were not thence admonished to enlarge the sphere as far as the nature of the government would admit? This was the only defense against the inconveniences of democracy consistent with the democratic form of government. All civilized societies would be divided into different sects, factions, and interests, as they happen to consist of rich and poor, debtors and creditors, the landed, the manufacturing, the commercial interests, the inhabitants of this district or that district, the followers of this political leader or that political leader, the disciples of this religious sect or that religious sect. In all cases where a majority are united by a common interest or passion, the rights of the minority are in danger. What motives are to restrain them? A prudent regard to the maxim that honesty is the best policy is found by experience to be as little regarded by bodies of men as by individuals. Respect for character is always diminished in proportion to the number among whom the blame or praise is to be divided. Conscience, the only remaining tie, is known to be inadequate in individuals. In large numbers, little is to be expected from it. Besides, religion itself may become a motive to persecution and oppression. These observations are verified by the histories of every country, ancient and modern. In Greece and Rome, the rich and poor, the creditors and debtors, as well as the patricians and plebeians, alternately oppressed each other with equal unmercifulness. What a source of oppression was the relation between the parent cities of Rome, Athens, and Carthage, and their respective provinces, the former possessing the power and the latter being sufficiently distinguished to be separate objects of it. Why was America so justly apprehensive of parliamentary injustice? Because Great Britain had a separate interest, real or supposed, and if her authority had been admitted, could have been pursued that interest at our expense. We have seen the mere distinction of color made in the most enlightened period of time. a ground of the most oppressive dominion ever exercised by man over man. What has been the source of those unjust laws complained of among ourselves? Has it not been the real or supposed interests of the major number? Debtors had defrauded their creditors. The landed interest has borne hard on the mercantile interest. The holders of one species of property have thrown a disproportion of taxes on the holders of another species. The lessons we are to draw from the whole is that where a majority are united by a common sentiment and have an opportunity, the rights of the minor party become insecure. In a Republican government, the majority, if united, have always an opportunity. The only remedy is to enlarge the sphere and thereby divide the community into so great a number of interests and parties that in the first place a majority will not be likely at the same moment to have a common interest separate from that of the whole or of the minority. In the second place, that in case they should have such an interest, they may not be apt to unite in the pursuit of it. It was incumbent on us then to try this remedy, and with that view to reframe a Republican system on such a scale and in such a form as will control all the evils which have been experienced.
Okay, so that was a lot, right? And I think we could dissect a lot of this. So Madison, I think, was taking everybody to school here by basically pointing out, and he opens the door for Montesquieu and his insights on a republic, because if it doesn't come up now, I know it later comes up in other debates when they start talking about the size of the republic, because Madison is actually talking about increasing the size, you know, increasing the districts, increasing these bodies so that you water down the majority so that there's not any majority anymore. Now, because he gives us a great history of how there's constantly, it goes from one control, one majority, whomever has the control oppresses everybody else. And then when it becomes their turn, they kick it up a notch, right? There's that term, there's that emerald term. Let's kick it up a notch, and we'll show them just how oppressive we can be. And it's almost like this race to the bottom of who can be the most oppressive and evil. All of these things are characteristics of government. But one of the things that they didn't account for, that they were going to stumble into, was a hybrid. Because, I mentioned Montesquieu. So Montesquieu, in his view of a republic, the best republic was that one of a small, so that it could be maintained and that it would be not dominated by necessarily majority. But Madison basically says when you do get that majority, then you just have to, and he believed you had to increase it. As looking at what they were talking about in increasing the size, representation, apportionment, all of that, it was under the skew that there would be a single central government, because again, the government at hand that they were discussing, the resolutions, and they were moving forward in fulfilling or, you know, trying to fill in the blanks of this centralized government where the states would literally become administrative entities. What ended up happening is this hybrid constitutional republic. You'll see this in my writing all the time. A hybrid constitutional republic is a republic that is at multiple levels. In other words, when we look at the national republic, it is a collection of sovereign states. When you take one state out of the union, or you just grab one state from the union and say, this right here is a republic itself. It is a republic of these independent counties. So now you have three republics, because you have a county republic, which is very small. You have a state republic, which is large, unless you're Rhode Island or, you know, some of these other little teeny states, but which is, you know, the states are usually very large. And then you're looking at the national republic, which is huge. I mean, this is one of the reasons why in the Federalist Papers and during the ratification debates, what have you, there was all this pointing to this national republic is too big. It is going to fail because in the day of Montesquieu, they never fathomed this concept of a limited power government. Governments had general powers. It was up to the governors who decided by discretion of how they were going to govern their people. They never thought about giving them limited and defined powers like they ended up doing in this convention. Therefore, when you look at the powers granted to the federal government, they're so limited and so defined that they fit the role and responsibility of the size and magnitude of the republic, if that makes sense. Because they're only going to fight the wars. They're going to maintain the national security and maintain this interface from the Union with the world on commerce. So in other words, they have these very limited roles to represent us and to protect us as a sovereign union as well as independent sovereign states. Now you get into the state level. Well, we didn't do a very good job there because we gave all the powers to the state. Right, wrong, or indifferent, we failed to give powers to our county government and then create a state government as a general government. This is where we need to go. Why counties matter most, this will be the logical conclusion. When you read this and get to the end of that, you say, this is what we need to do. The final article is the one that basically talks about our First Amendment right and creating constitutional counties and creating, you know, actualizing this hybrid constitutional republic by creating constitutions at the county level. Now, does it end there? When we go down and down and down, we drill down to a smaller level. Now we've got the county. Does that mean that the county is the base unit in this hybrid constitutional republic? Not necessarily. What do you do about a county that has 10 million people in it, like Los Angeles? Sean, what would you do with Los Angeles, with that many people in a republic, realizing that that's just too many people to give adequate representation at the county level? Doesn't that make sense?
Yes, sir. Okay. First thing I would do would be send ICE in, and then we'd take about half of that off. That's a good start.
Okay. All right, 5 million still for a county is still a lot of people. So if the whole point is that first we have to agree that when you have a county of set, the magnitude of the population is so great that you don't have good representation. So this is the real question, because we've talked about this before, and I've let it be chewed on, and I'm going to let it get chewed on some more now. We talked about how a county can be too small because it can't sustain itself. Now we're talking about a county that's too big because you can't have good representation. This is the other extreme, right?
Correct. Yeah, you definitely have to split that up.
Yeah, you'd have to. You have to divide that. But do you divide that as a county, or do you divide, in other words, you divide it into 5 or 10 counties? No, I would not do that, because it's still about the same geographic size of all the rest of the counties. What you would have to do is the county itself would become a general republic representing the districts, you know, and or, you know, a baron is a baron over what?
I have no idea.
Okay, because I'm trying to come up with, a count was the leader over a county. And so I was just trying to come up with some sub-names that you could put underneath, like a duke. So let's say and we're going into break right here. Let's come up with a name that we could give, for the reign of a duke. So in other words, we've got a duke, and we're going to have multiple dukes that are reigning different districts or the district duke. That's what we'll do. It came to me. So when we come back, we'll talk about districts and dukes, where the dukes will become the governor of the district. And maybe the baron of the county or the count of the county. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so I'm not sure if you heard what I said, because when the volume goes down, you can probably barely hear what I'm saying. But the county, so parishes come from the Catholic structure of governing. And we have parishes, so maybe, I don't know, whoever's going to lead as the executive, right? So let me back up. The way our government has been framed, we have three branches of government. We're to have an executive, legislative, and a judiciary, the legislative being the sovereigns, the executive being the enforcer of the law, and the judiciary basically is the overseer of the justice system. They can't make no law, they can't enforce law, blah, blah, blah. They're pretty much, kind of passive. And, no luster. And that's one of the reasons why John Jay didn't want to go back to becoming a Supreme Court justice and the Chief Justice, because it was just too passive. I mean, look it up. When they offered him to go back to the Supreme Court, he said, that's a dead-end job. There's nothing for us to do. Anyway, so in England, the county was created by the land barons. See, the land barons were elevated from being these land barons to counties or counts, because the land that they created, or the land that they were barons over, ended up becoming counties because the counts ruled the counties. And so if this is making sense, the king ruled the kingdom and the counties made up the kingdom. So the king, we exchanged the executive title to, president, and then we created an executive title for the states instead of president or king. We created that as governor. So we've already got the title for the executive for the federal and the state governments. What do we call the executive for a district? And so this is the question I ask you. Wouldn't it be appropriate to call the executive the count?
It sounds good to me.
Yeah, and the districts within the county that may be, subdivided, you'd call them dukes. Now, you'd have to break these districts down to where they could fund themselves and they can function, where they wouldn't need to have, in other words, what you would do at the county level is you would probably delegate to the county government the ability for water, water refining, sewage, and disposal, garbage. The public services would be delegated to the county, right? So that the county of Los Angeles took care of those services that the lower governments would be more of just the regional, controlling the traffic of the districts, whether that's a red light or a stop sign, blah, 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 blah. So you kind of shift things down a little bit to where you don't want to disturb, because last thing you want is you want each district to have its own, start creating duplication of water, filtration or water services, sewage services, trash services, because when you break it down, that costs more money to do that. The economy of scale is to consolidate and try to let a more efficient means kind of prevail. And usually, when you get it into a larger company or what have you, they do better than a bunch of small competing companies. We do it for less money, less people, so forth and so on. So anyway, that being what it is, I would just say that, okay, so the count would be, you know, the executive and be providing at the county services down to all the districts. The districts would, their executive would then, because now you're talking about, let's say it, you break it down to 1 million people to be in a district. So if that's it, then the executive of that district would be a duke. How's that sound? You like that?
Sound good.
Okay. So if necessary, and if you have to drill down below that, and technically you should, the lower level of the district would probably be regions, if you want to call them regions, or areas, or whatever you want to call these sub-elements of the district. And those would be your legislators, your representatives, that would be for your district. You'd have the duke, and then you would have your own, you know, your judiciary, your own judge, for kind of maintaining the common law of the people within the district. Now, the sub-districts would basically just be divided by creating the areas for electing your legislators, because that's how we do it today with counties. I mean, most of the, you know, medium counties, they have 3, 5, 7 districts, and that's how many commissioners or supervisors that get elected to go into that supervisory board, commissioner, board of commissioners, what have you. So the point is that breaking the districts down, or breaking the county down, it would be incumbent of doing that in such a way that, so here's the question. Actually, I don't want to speak to being the king here, or the duke, or the count. When you have a county and you're going to break it into districts, What would be the best way? Would you want to play what people would call gerrymandering, so that you wouldn't have, you know, hard red and hard blue districts? You'd have everybody commingling to where, you know, it could go either way. Or, you know, how would you break it down politically? If does that make sense?
Yes, sir. I was just wondering that. I mean, I don't know how you guess you would have to have some kind of committee to come to some kind of compromise on that.
Well, so the true essence
fit within the natural environment of the area you're talking about.
Okay, so the true essence of the framers and how they looked at government was communities. They wanted to make sure that the community didn't get split up. So that what you'd end up doing was you would basically create, you know, as best as you can, a district of equal sizes within the county, these however many districts of equal size population-wise, so that each district had equal representation. Now, technically, you could actually create, in a district, if your district was 1,000 people, right? Inside the district, you would have these areas, and those areas would break that down to where if you had, well, let me see here. We had 1 million people within a district. I think that's how we broke it down, right? So if we had 1 million people in a district, you would probably want to break that 1 million people down to a reasonable level of representation. What do you believe would be reasonable?
I have no idea. I mean, for one representative to represent a community.
Uh-huh. For one representative, I would probably venture to say somewhere around 40, 50, maybe 60,000, not more than 60,000, but maybe less. It's okay at a district level to have, because if you have a million and you just break the million down to 50,000, right, that means that you have 20 district representatives at the district level. Right? Is that not right?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So when we look at Orange County has, I think, 26 county representatives, legislators. Orange County, New York. Because it's a big county. It's right, it's the county right next to New York. I mean, it abuts to New York City. And so there's a lot of people that live there. It's a huge, you know, suburb of New York. So they've got a lot of legislators. So my point is that this is where you break these districts down. You break them down into manageable representation so that at the district level, you absolutely have your, you know, this is where your government is more affecting your everyday life than anything else. At the county level, there'd be, like we said, if it's 10 million, there'd be 10 districts, 5 million, 5 districts. So at the county level, you would actually have one representative that would represent everybody in the district. That would be the 1 million people. And in the county as well, you would have a district that would have a senator where the district government, in other words, when you look at all of the districts, right, so you have the county and 10 districts, each of the districts actually has, we broke it down to 20, right? So we've got 20 people there, and those 20 people would be kind of representing the area. So the district itself would actually have what I would call that those legislators, they would choose the senator that would actually be sitting at the county seat. So you'd actually, at the county level, be creating a bicameral legislative body where the people are represented in the House at the county, and that the county, or I should say the districts, are being represented in the Senate. Makes sense, right? So what we want to do is we want to make sure that there's these checks and balances to keep a democracy from getting a foothold and taking government sideways. So the point is that, and I went down this rat hole, so forgive me, everybody. The point is that, you know, what these men were doing at this point in time, they were still figuring it out. Now we can actually see the benefit and how we can reverse engineer what they did and how they could drill down and create smaller governments and smaller governments instead of drilling up and creating bigger ones to where people get the adequate representation that meets their needs so that they actually have voice at the lowest level of government possible as well as at the highest level. Because regardless of how it goes, each county would have a minimum of one representative in the House, and they would actually have their own senator. Each county would have their own senator if we followed the rule of the state or the federal legislature based on the people choose their representative and the government chooses their senators. Okay, so that means that if you have 10 million people in your county, there may be accommodations to allow based on population that, okay, so let me ask you this. Is it better to create a larger pool or a larger venue for the state of California, or would it be better for California to break into 4, 5, 6 states?
I think it would be better if they broke into different states.
Amen. Thank you so much. And so it would be ridiculous to try to create a population problem. Because that's exactly what would happen. And what they would want to do is they would want to actually carve out San Diego and all of those counties, L.A. and a bunch of counties, San Francisco, a bunch of counties, Sacramento and a bunch of counties, because then the population center would literally rule the, you know, I'll just say the rural areas, and it would be just as bad, if not worse, in these new states. I believe the way it should happen, I believe Congress probably needs to step in and say, look, we need to, you know, because the people that live in the rural areas do not share your opinion of governing. They don't like the way you're going to steal their water and take away their, you know, their ability to, you know, make food and the things that they try to do to make a living. Therefore, I think it would be incumbent upon the somebody, an arbiter, or I should say, what do you call that, a conservator, to go into a state like that and to make sure that the rural area is kind of protected. You may have, you know, because California is a pretty big area. When you go from northern all the way to southern on its interior, where there's hardly anybody that lives there. But there's still probably, you're still probably talking about 2 million people. And so that, I would say that would be a state. And then you would literally create almost a state out of L.A. and a state out of San Francisco, Oakland area, and a state out of Sacramento. And then you could create these other maybe two or three large, and actually you got to have San Diego, and I'll call it the L.A. Basin because there's Orange County anyway. But I would look at trying to create a parity to where you're not destroying or creating an oppression of a bunch of people that would never get their views in their government. In other words, like I said, the rural people being dominated by the population center. Because that's one of the things we were reading here by Madison, getting back to what Madison was saying, that we needed to make sure that the majority cannot override the minority to become oppressive. Well, the best way to do that is to try to create circumstances that takes away, because we can clearly see, am I right or am I wrong on this, that the people that are growing up in population centers have a completely different political spectrum than people that don't grow up in the cities.
Correct.
Okay. All right. So what that means is that the paradigm of the education system is being cast, because we don't have a society that's educated. We have a society that's indoctrinated. And so the society that's indoctrinated is these population centers. And it's all about assuming more control, blah, blah, blah. When we can put it in contrast to the rural areas, you know, this is an area where there may be some indoctrination, but they're obviously not thinking in the same light, in the same vein as, you know, socialism and that crap that's being ran down the throats in these population centers. So my point is this, is that there needed to be some kind of conservatorship to protect the good people that would be dominated by breaking California up. Because everybody wants to have a political outcome. And I believe that it's important to protect the minorities, as Madison was pointing out here. So anyway, that was a long, long rat hole trip. I'm sorry about that. But that all makes sense, right? How we would want to actually start drilling down and even considering breaking up states if they become... Texas is pretty soon going to be needed to be broken up, because there are more people moving to Texas. As I look at the last apportionment breakdown from the 2010 to the 2020 census, California lost 11 representatives. They're standing to lose another double digits of representatives. So in other words, they went from 50 down to maybe low 30s or maybe a 20. In other words, in half. Their population has been, you know, I would just say so adversely affected, because so many people are moving out of that state, to where pretty soon California will probably have hardly any control and say in the federal government anymore like they used to. So anyway, there's lots of reasons why I would advocate breaking California up, lots of reasons. But primarily the important thing that we want to make sure is that we protect the individuals or the communities and their paradigms, because there's nothing worse than be living in a state where a population center is dominating you and they're destroying you. They're taking your money and they're doing all the things that you just don't agree with. That is, excuse the expression, that's a hell that nobody deserves to be in. Anyway, let's move
on. Isn't that similar to what's going on in Oregon? Is it Oregon or Washington where, like, both, there's a big group of counties that want to secede from the state they're yes. in and join Idaho?
Both. So California, all three, California, Oregon, and Washington are trying to do, you know, these rural areas. They're all trying to create a 51st state or do something to get away from the oppression of the population centers. If folks, if this doesn't scare you, we're at that point where people are getting desperate. It's about time to start gnawing off arms just to get away. And so that's one of the reasons why these blue states are being abandoned. People are moving into the interior just to get away from them. Hey, having a beachfront property is not worth this. Anyway, so there are some real issues, there are arguments, and I've engaged with some of these people, like Paul Preston, I've talked to him before, and others. But the point is that when we look at what they're trying to do, I don't think that they're really trying to fix the problem. I just think that they're trying to obtain a solution that is better than what they've got and not really deal with the problem or fix the problem. Because, again, we got to go back to the fundamentals. What is appropriate representation? And, you know, what is the, you know, how do we break down these bodies, or I should say the geographical areas for government? Because we know right now that stripping across these zones or communities to basically create severance between them so that we get political outcomes, that's just wrong. Anyway, so the two things that the takeaway that we can easily see right now is that we need to maintain the continuity of the communities in creating representation. We need to come up with and define what is reasonable. I think 50,000 is reasonable. I think that's a reasonable number, not to exceed that. Try not to exceed 50,000. So anyway, let's try Mr. Dixon or Dickinson. What's he bringing to the table here?
Mr. Dickinson considered it as essential that one branch of the legislature should be drawn immediately from the people, and as expedient that the others should be chosen by the legislatures of the states. This combination of the state governments with the national government was as politic as it was unavoidable. In the formation of the Senate, we ought to carry it through such a refining process as will assimilate it as near as may be to the House of Lords in England. He repeated his warm eulogiums on the British Constitution. He was for a strong national government, but for leaving the states a considerable agency in the system. The objection against making the former dependent on the latter might be obviated by giving to the Senate an authority permanent and irrevocable for 3, 5, or 7 years. Being thus independent, they would speak and decide with becoming freedom.
Okay, so what do you think about that? I mean, what do you think about what, you know, he's throwing out there? That he's actually looking at having the people choose one part of the legislature and then having the states basically choose another.
I think it makes sense. It seems like it would be a good way to address the concerns and to create a balance.
Yeah, so when we get to the Sherman Compromise, I think basically this right here was the seed that I think started churning in Sherman's head where he articulated and everybody kind of agreed, yeah, you know, let's give the people representation and we'll give the states representation. Yeah, because Dickinson was the one that just kind of threw that out there and covered both bases. Okay, so
How does our House of Representatives and Senate eventually compare to the House of Lords and the House of Commons they have in British Parliament?
Okay, so the House of Commons is supposedly elected by the people. Now, we're going to get into this in the ratification base because they talk about it, that the people really don't get a chance. They don't have good representation because small communities have equal or have greater representation than some of these big communities because of their affluence. So in other words, Parliament is kind of a caste system where more weight is given to the affluence or the value of the property and the people living in the area that has representation. And so that's the House of Commons, so that there's, you know, some areas that scarcely have representation. The House of Lords is where the affluent technically have two representatives. The affluent are the ones because the House of Lords is selected by an aristocracy that chooses who these people are going to be. Those people that get to choose who is going to fill the seats in the House of Lords, they also equally have a vote and influence in those who are running in the House of Commons. In other words, they get to influence both sides.
Right. So it's kind of, it's false. It's a false pretense.
Yes. Yeah. Correct. I mean, they've
kind of like what we've evolved to now, where the people who had the means to fund and donate to whoever donates the most to whoever, that's who you're going to get the policies instituted that they want to benefit themselves.
Right. A government of lobbyists. Right. And of affluence. Correct. Yes. So as we kind of wrap up, we've got basically about 20-some-odd seconds, and then a series of another 15, so less than a minute. Yes, you're absolutely right. You're very astute on that, that the House of Commons, the House of Lords, is a rigged system. And when we look at when we have a million people, and who – so we're so screwed up we don't understand republicanism. And this is one of the reasons why, you know, I was thinking about maybe discussing the Bill of Rights for the 21st century as a premise to start honing how we see these issues. What is republicanism? What is our republican form of government? What should it be? And so as we discuss these things, in reading this, we can kind of see, you know, how brilliant what they did was for their time, but what we need to do to preserve and protect and, you know, jealously guard those people who are to represent us from any outside influence. I'm J.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.